All right, so welcome back, everybody. So that was the original plan, to have a Crustaceans tribute to Hans Meinhardt. But we can also easily have a boy. Is boys around? No. But anyway, what I really want to stress here is that we have limited exposure to equations so far. I mean, the biologists. But, you know, our experience both with Maja during weekend and also with Boris today has been very pleasant. So it was the first time that somebody throws equations at me and I don't freak out. So basically we can organize something, you know, under limited time pressure so that, you know, you can introduce us more and more into mechanical models of morphogenesis. But nevertheless, I think this course is the right setting to also commemorate the contribution of Hans Meinhardt to the field of developmental morphogenesis. So Hans Meinhardt, as most of you know, he has been trained as a physicist, but then he spent all his career thinking about developmental problems. And although I'm primarily familiar with his ideas about appendage morphogenesis, nevertheless, I was really surprised to see to how many different fields he has made contributions, ranging from hydroid generation to segmentation, the chirality, the patterning of the snail cells, and so on. I really have no clue how influential these other models have been, but when it comes to arthropod or insect morphogenesis, he has been extremely influential. And I want to demonstrate this by copying some of his drawings. So essentially, back in 1982, he proposed the so-called boundary model to explain the patterning of insect limbs. And just in one sentence, he was able to concentrate all these amazing insights. So he said that boundaries resulting from the primary embryonic organization of a developing organism act as organizing regions for secondary embryonic fields. Okay? So this, I guess, needs some explanation. But what he means, so by secondary embryonic fields, we refer to limbs. Because the appendages, the limbs, are formed during embryogenesis de novo, okay? They have to somehow orient relative to the primary body axis, which is the anterior, posterior, and the dorsal ventral. And back then, just to give some context, what he knew back then was that the tissues in Drosophila, and what later was the case also in vertebrates, is that the tissues and the organs are not patterned as a whole, but they become progressively subdivided into distinct domains, and the cells do not mix with each other, so these are the so-called compartments. So he knew already from some seminal work by Bellido and others in Drosophila that the tissue in the Drosophila wing, the same also applies to the leg, they are subdivided into distinct compartments. But nevertheless, we had no clue about what is expressed at the interface between these two cell populations. It took another 10 or 12 years before Drosophilids were able to identify the morphogens that you heard from Suzanne, DPP, wingless, etc., that are expressed at the interface between compartments, then they control the patterning and the growth of the tissue. Nevertheless, what was really insightful in Meinhardt's models is that in order to develop a novel proximodistal axis, this can be done at the intersection of the pre-existing anterior, posterior, and dorsoventral axis, shown here. And this, of course, very nicely illustrates for the wing. So in the wing, you have this perfect Cartesian, let's say, orthogonal system of DPP being expressed in the AP compartment boundary and wingless in the DV compartment boundary. And me, personally, was wondering for many years, why is he drawing, so the corresponding, let's say, system in the leg is not divided into four sectors, so into four compartments like here, but into three. And finally, I found out what is the answer, and I will share it with you later on. But again, in the main idea is the same, that again, you have a cross-section between the AP and the DV system, and this is where the proximodistal axis develops, okay? Of course, as you heard extensively, and I guess you will be hearing from Ken as well, Drosophila is the model, the best model available for arthropod leg morphogenesis. And of course, in the case of Drosophila, because of its metamorphic mode of development, you have different stages for different parts of patterning and growth and differentiation. So the specification of the limb primordia takes place during embryogenesis. The patterning and the growth takes place during the larval stages, and the elaboration and differentiation of the different parts of the segments of the limb takes place during prepupal and pupal development. And again, for me, I worked for several years in many different arthropod species, And I was always wondering how we can compare different, you know, insects that make direct projection from the body wall during embryogenesis to this model, or in other words, how the Meinhardt model can be applied to the Drosophila paradigm. In other words, you have both, you know, you need to think that the Drosophila primordium needs to integrate the AP and DV bar, the DV signals twice during embryogenesis to specify, and then during patterning for the actual growth of the appendage. So already when I was a PhD student, I was looking at this again, demonstrated here, that you have different processes taking place at different parts of embryogenesis, and it's impossible right now to basically study limb morphogenesis in Drosophila as a continuum. Okay. So as a PhD student, I was really looking around to find alternative models that could be used, you know, to complement the Drosophila paradigm and see how we can arrive at some basic principles that organize limb morphogenesis. And don't take me wrong, I spent, you know, quite some time in my career working on Drosophila itself. And because Susan and others here are working on the wing, I think that this is by far the best Galford driver to drive things in the wing primordium. Okay? So for example, if you drive a version of the Hoxin called ultrabithorax, you can very nicely transform only specifically the wing blade into the Haldir capitellum, this balloon shape. Okay? All right, so going back to this phylogenetic tree of the arthropods that I showed you last week, back in 2000 when I was doing my PhD, it became really obvious that the insects are essentially terrestrial crustaceans. So they have evolved from within the crustaceans. That's why many people were actively seeking for a new model for crustacean development. And of course, the crustaceans, in terms of morphological diversity, are incomparable to any other animal group. And this morphological diversity is not only between crustacean groups, but also within the same body plan, within the same species. So I was lucky enough, at around the same time that I was starting my PhD, that some people, both in Europe and in the US, were concentrating their efforts on a new emerging crustacean model called Parialia hawaiensis. So Parialia is an amphipod. In other words, the body plan is laterally compressed. So this is a lateral view, okay? And the name comes from the bidirectional orientation of the limbs. So some of the limbs point posteriorly, and some of them point anteriorly. So this is what defines the name of this species. And all we knew back then, when I started my PhD, is that it's very easy to keep this animal in the lab. This you have also witnessed here in the course. We can get access to hundreds of embryos year-round, and of course we could put some single crosses. But that's all we had in our hands back then. Okay. Okay. This is always a good reminder. So the other piece of evidence is that there was this amazing lineage of German researchers in the Humboldt University, and the last, I would say, representative is Karsten, who have, you know, they were making these amazing movies of development without having any live tracers or fluorescent reporters. And this is amazing. I mean, you can identify the chromatin and the cell phase and the cell junctions, you know, without any staining at all. Okay? This is just brilliant. This is a dream of any developmental biologist, correct? So I was thinking, okay, what will happen if we can also start applying some of these amazing tools that we have for Drosophila and other model species in this group of animals, in the amphipod crustaceans? So this is very early stage. So this is when the embryo proper, the embryo, the primordium is organized. And if I let this play now for another 30 seconds, you see that the cells will start getting organized in very precise rows. So this is anterior, where this is the head, these are the head lobes of the animal. And now you have organization of the trunk. And you see that the different parasegments, like in Drosophila, they become organized in very precise rows of cells. Have a look at this. And again, this is a process, like in vertebrate segmentation, it happens sequentially. So the more anterior segments form earlier and the more posterior ones later. So do you see these very precise rows? I guess myosin accumulates at the interface, but we have never done this. Okay. But, you know, this was some very good evidence that this is a right choice of a new animal model to concentrate efforts. So during my PhD time with Michalis Averov in Greece and then with Michael Eckham in Cambridge, we started developing all the tools that would allow us one day to probe apparent morphogenesis. And one of the first things that we saw, of course, I summarize here work that took over 10 years or longer. One of the first things we were able to do is perturb gene expression, like Hox genes. So we could get this head to thorax transformations. You see a very nice segmentation of the head capsule. Okay? Or another famous, we can recapitulate another famous mutation from Drosophila, the antennapedia. Now you have a leg developing in place of the antenna, or legs developing in place of the mouth parts. Or the more dramatic ones is when we transform the whole left side of the animal into thoracic, into walking appendages, while this side of the animal remains unaffected. I will come to this in a second. And more recently, again, by taking advantage of new technologies like the CRISPR-Cas, our collaborator Nipam Patel in Berkeley, he has been able to systematically perturb all the expression of all the Hox genes and define exactly what is the Hox code that defines the different types of appendages. I have to say that unlike Drosophila, where you have a few different cell appendage types, in the case of Pariale, it's like, you know, living Swiss Army knives. You have 18 different types of appendages. Okay. So the first part, let's say, of our focus on Pariale was strictly on genetic basis of appendage morphogenesis, or appendage diversification, to be more precise. So we're trying to understand what type of genes are expressed to give rise to the blue, the green, the yellow, and the magenta appendages shown here. And of course, what are the cross-regulatory interactions that stabilize these identities. And at around 2011, when I was looking around for jobs, what I want to really to make the shift into the cellular basis of morphogenesis. So instead of going straight from the gene expression to the final morphology, I want to understand what are the functional units doing. So how do they interpret all these genetic cues and to produce the final morphology of the leg? And if you think about it, it's a much simpler problem. So Eric described his pioneering, you know, screen in embryos, and he came up only with about 200 genes in total. They were extremely, let's say, lucky if you want, because you had all this maternal contribution, so they could identify only the zygotic component that is really important to specify the segments in Drosophila. But if you do such a screen to identify what genes are important for wing morphogenesis nowadays, you can come up with thousands of genes. And obviously, it's very, very difficult to identify, you know, what genes are the key players in the whole process. On the other hand, if one focuses on cell behaviors, we can already envisage that there are only a handful of different cell behaviors that can establish, that can change tissue proportions and lead to organ morphogenesis. In other words, and this is essentially the conceptual framework that I start applying to my own research, I would like to start by describing the cellular behaviors that are important for a particular process, and then going one step down and see what genes have been described in the literature as being really important for this process at the cellular level, and study only these genes. And this is, again, we have discussed extensively already that, for example, cell intercalation is required for the axial elongation in bilaterians. What has been already described very nicely in Drosophila is that you have oriented cell divisions are as a major driving force for cell shape control. And then, of course, in the case of the vertebrate limb, you have both patterned cell proliferation and cell death to produce the final pattern. So using, again, this famous onion scheme, this talk will be entirely describing the cell dynamics that we have been trying to understand during Pariale limb morphogenesis. Okay, again, one thing that should become clear in this course is that no scientist can live alone in isolation, especially in modern days. Okay, you have to step on the shoulder of giants, as Newton put it, in order to progress. And these are the giants that I stepped on their shoulders. Okay. So I wouldn't have been able to basically carry out the analysis that I will tell you now unless Pavel Tomanczak had hosted me as a postdoc in the Max Planck Institute in Dresden, and later on Philip Keller and Janela helped me set up my lab. And of course, this has been a very complicated interaction and project that required a lot of different expertise. So we had a very joyful interaction with Carsten, who is also a biologist and contributed dramatically to the lineage reconstruction that I will describe. And of course, Tobias and Zaniv are the computer scientists who developed the tools that we use to be able to follow cells at single, to follow the cell behaviors at single cell resolution. All right, so why Pareale? What are the distinct, let's say, qualities of Pareale that make it an appealing model to study limb morphogenesis? First of all, it's a direct developer. Again, I will describe this in more detail. Secondly, the tempo and mode of embryogenesis. Tempo, I mean slow developer. Forget about Drosophila and zebrafish. In this case, embryogenesis takes place over 10 days. In other words, you don't necessarily need to have access to Philips scopes or Lolassi scopes. You can get away with more conventional microscopes or light microscopes. Secondly, the stereotype, and by mode I mean the total cleavage. So unlike insects that have a syncytial mode of embryogenesis, these guys have total cleavages. And again, as you will come to appreciate, this has important implications for genetic approaches in this species. Secondly, the stereotypy of many cellular processes. This applies both to early embryogenesis, when you have a stereotypic arrangement of blastomers, as well as during the later organization of the germ bank. Of course, we discussed already the appendage diversity. And last but not least, over the last 15 years now, we have been able to develop a, you know, to develop a toolkit that allows us to carry out both gain and loss of function experiments. Okay, this slide describes the Pareale life cycle that takes place at 10 days at 25 degrees. And you can already appreciate that the embryo is, the egg cell is really transparent. And you can very nicely see inside. So the first cleavages are total and produce a stereotypic arrangement of 8 blastomers at about 8 hours after egg lay. We can uniquely identify all the different cells based on their relative size, their position, and also their contacts. And what became apparent by doing this early phase map analysis is that already at the A-cell stage, you have commitment of each of these blastomers to a single germ layer. Okay? So this is the earliest known animal species in terms of cell fate specification. It does it even faster than C. elegans, that was considered the champion so far. Another point that I would like to make is that although you have this mosaic mode of development, nevertheless, the embryo has a very high capacity to respond to ablation. So if you ablate any of these blastomers, you don't get gaps in the forming embryo, but somehow the other cells can replace, at least for the first 2 days or so, they can replace the missing cells. So later on, the cell cleavages, the cell divisions are superficial, so the cells excrete the yolk towards the center of the egg. And then you have aggregation of the cells to form the embryonic rudiment. Over the next 2 days, segmentation takes place, so you see progressive growth of the germ bank posteriorly, and then it folds here. Unlike Drosophila that folds dorsally, these animals fold ventrally, and they continue growing as more segments are added sequentially at the posterior end. Halfway during embryogenesis, the limbs become really apparent, okay? And by day 9 or so, embryogenesis looks, or organogenesis looks complete. You have formation of the compound eyes, and the, 1 day later, the animal hatches.
How many molts are there between those 10 days and 2 months?
I would say there are about, on average, they molt every week or so. Is that correct?
Can you do the same kind of experiments like that were done in cockroach legs and delete, I mean, make?
Yes, I'll show you. Yes. Yes?
How many of those blastomer cells can I delete before it doesn't work anymore, before the...
All right. So basically, you have complementation groups. So essentially, you have three big blastomers that give rise to the ectoderm. You can kill up to two of these, and the remaining one will replace the other two. You have three cells that give rise to the mesoderm. And again, if you delete up to one or two, you can replace. But then you have the germline and the endoderm that if you kill them, you lose it. Nevertheless, if you kill the germline, and this is very recent, we knew for several years, if you kill the germline, the hatchling, this guy here, has no germ cells in the in its gonads, but somehow it gets new ones later during life. And it has been a mystery. Which is the blastomer, or which is the lineage that replaces the missing germ cells? And if I'm correct, it must be this one. Okay, probably it will come out soon. Maybe you can ask Cassandra. She has been involved in this study. All right. About the body plan of Pareale. Again, I told you that it's laterally compressed. This is a lateral view, and basically the body is divided into three parts. So you have the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. Although Carsten keeps calling it glion, for the simple reason that abdomen is for limbless tagmata, like in the insects, while these guys, because they are full of appendages, they have to be called glion. But in any case, we mean the same thing. And then the species is sexual and dimorphic, and probably this is one of one spontaneous mutant that we recovered. Probably you can see that this appendage is small and the opposite one is large. So this is how females are. They have small grasping appendages, the T3 is small, while in the males it's large. I don't know if you can call this a gynandromorph, but it's a spontaneous mutant that we recovered from our cultures. And it's quite often to recover this kind of animals. Okay? But essentially, you can very nicely identify males and females. What will happen is the male will grasp the female and will hold it for a day or so until fertilization. Going back to this slide, we can very nicely dissect these eggs out of the mother pouch. So the eggs are kept in a pouch. We can dissect them out and keep them in artificial seawater. And you know, we can dissect them at any point during development. And then when it comes to appendage diversity, I told you there are 18 pairs of different appendages. I'm showing you only 6 here, so that you can get an appreciation of the appendage diversity. So this is representative of the gnathal appendages that are used for food processing. This is the first thoracic appendage, and it has a mixed identity. So between the gnathal ones and the more posterior thoracic ones, these are the famous maxillipeds. Many different crustacean orders, by the way, have independently evolved maxillipeds. In other words, anterior thoracic appendages that are not used for locomotion, but they are used for feeding. And they have used the very same change in the expression of the Hawk gene ultrabythorax. The more posterior ones, they are used for grasping. So you nicely see that they have different shapes in their. All these guys have the same number of segments, okay? But what really changes is the size and the shape of the different segments. And then if you go to the more posterior abdominal ones, you see very nicely that they're again medially fused, unlike these ones, and they are branched. So instead of having a single limb branch, they have two branches distally, okay? So to put it simply, natural selection has done the job for us and has produced a multitude of different appendage morphologies. So we can go and by just imaging a single embryo, we can get the cellular, you know, basis of appendage diversification. Which one? Sorry.
Those bristles on the end of, are those
this one. So these are used for swimming. So these are And you see that these are basically the two, from the left and the right side. They are medially fused, so it functions as a paddle. All right, in terms of tools, we discussed this last week, but this is again to refresh your memory that with this animal we can do both gain and loss of function experiments. The embryos are amenable to all sorts of embryological manipulations like microinjection, isolation, and so on. And the more recent, this is the important point that I'd like to make. I told you about the early fate restriction at the 8-cell stage. There is an even earlier one at the 2-cell stage, which divides the left from the right side of the animal. In other words, by injecting our constructs at one of the two blastomers, we can essentially use half of the animal as our experiment and keep the other half as control. And more recently, we were able to sequence and assemble de novo the genome of these animals. So these guys have a huge genome, 3.6 gigabases. And this was a community effort by all crustacean labs, and particularly I have to acknowledge the Abu Baker lab in Oxford, who did all the bioinformatic analysis to put it together. So if you go to the NCBI website, you can see that it ranks fourth in all sequenced animal genomes so far. And even worse than that, when we did all the analysis, it proves that the parialic genome is even more complex than the human genome. So it has the same number of chromosomes, but it is more repetitive, it is more heterozygous, and it has higher levels of polymorphism. To such an extent that if you assemble the genome, the two alleles, so it's a diploid animal, the two alleles, they don't fall together, they don't collapse into a single contig, but they stay separate. That's why most of the genome has a low coverage, and only a small part of the genome has the high coverage. Okay? So all these were things that we had to consider in order to assemble the genome. That's why if you go to the NCBI website, you see that the predicted genome size is more than 4 gigabases because it keeps the two separate alleles as separate annotations. And then when it comes to imaging, the first, of course, efforts were done with confocal. And confocal is a great tool to follow two-dimensional epithelia like the early grid of pareales, so the early stages of segmentation. But when we try to follow with Karsten the cell behaviors in a developing limb, which is a three-dimensional structure, immediately we realized that the confocal had certain limitations. And this is the time when I contacted Pavel and I visited Dresden and so on, because he introduced us into light jet microscopy. Is anybody in this room who is not familiar with light jet microscopy to describe in more detail? So everybody is familiar with it. So essentially, you just, instead of acquiring a single view, you can rotate the specimen during acquisition and acquire multiple views, and then computationally, by using different means, you can fuse all the separate views into a single stack that combines information from the entire specimen. This is demonstrated here, so these are the input views. Normally, the other thing is because the animal develops very slowly, we have all the time of the world to rotate and acquire every 45 degrees. In other words, every nucleus is represented in at least two or even three or even four neighboring views. Okay? That's why when you fuse by using fancy multi-view deconvolution approaches, you get an almost isotropic resolution. This can be also seen by the beads that look really circular and not oblong. Of course, it's one thing to reconstruct a single time point, and a completely different if you want to follow cells in developing appendages over 4 or 5 days. Again, as Sebastian described, light jet microscopy is not an easy business. It's a data deluge, in fact. In our case, our standard data sets are between 7 and 10 terabytes. We acquire time points every 7.5 minutes, but nevertheless, we need to acquire them over 4 or 5 days of development. And what I will play now is, so this reconstruction, so just so that you can follow, this is anterior, this is the posterior. You see that the embryo has, this is the segmentation stage, so you will see that the germinal extends posteriorly, and then it will bend ventrally and continue extending anteriorly. And at the same time, I'm animating the embryo so that you can see that with these light jet microscopy approaches, we can have information from all cells involved in these processes. So this is the extending posterior of the animal. And at this point, you can start to see the first limb buds developing anteriorly. And then, as we already described, this animal adds segments sequentially. That's why you see also this anterior progression, posterior progression in terms of limb morphogenesis. Although this is a reconstruction, obviously you lose resolution. Nevertheless, you can appreciate that we have single cell resolution for most, at least, parts of the developing appendages. Okay. Just to give you an overview of appendage development for later on. So this is the early stage when you have the assembly of the cells in this very precise grid of cell. We will describe this in more detail later. You have the posterior extension of the germband, and then the limb buds start forming with anterior to posterior progression. The limb buds grow progressively along the proximodistal axis, and then they become subdivided progressively in more and more segments. And finally, you also develop these proximal structures, cuticle plates and gills, and the appendages acquire their final shape and size.
How do you define what's the body wall and what's the then, the interface? So at the beginning of...
So, basically, I will come to these details later on, but essentially what we know already, because we have this very nice geometric arrangement of cells, we know exactly what the more medial columns of cells will form. So we know that they will give rise to the neuroectoderm and to the sternites. Then we know that the central part of cells will give rise to the appendage itself, and the more lateral ones will give rise to the sternites. Okay? It's very easy to follow it in this cell and basically relate the final structures to the early ones. So just to paraphrase the PI of Karsten, this is an excellent group of animals because you can study a gene expression and function at single cell resolution. Okay? This is exactly the most important point. That if you could take one point from this talk, it's this one. All right, so back then, it was obvious that we can have all the imaging tools we want to image and reconstruct embryogenesis. But what we're really missing were the tools to extract biologically meaningful information. Especially in our case, we're interested in reconstructing lineages and cell dynamics. And this is when we joined forces with Tobias and Zanib. So Tobias was developing at the same time a tool that is already very very famous called BigDataViewer. This is a Fiji plugin that allows people to browse through multi-terabyte, multi-view datasets in acquired by light microscopy. Obviously, you can use it with conventional data as well. And then at the same time, Zanib had developed an annotation engine, meaning that it's a tool that allows you to track cells over time. So these guys joined efforts, and they produced Mammoth. Mammoth stands for Massive Multi-View Tracker. And essentially, it's an engine that allows you, first of all, to browse on the fly through these terabyte multi-view datasets, and at the same time, reconstruct your lineages. And this is how it looks like. So you acquire your multi-view datasets, you calculate the registration parameters, and then you feed the raw data together with the registration into Mammoth. There is an optional step that you can also fuse your data and import this as an extra view. Okay? Do you follow me? So essentially, I have to highlight here that the most computationally demanding step in the whole process of LightCT image processing is the fusion. It can take several weeks to months. So for people who do not have access to clusters, etc., this is a very nice feature that you essentially can work with the raw data. Okay. Another thing, as a biologist, that I really like about Mammoth is the fact that you can have access to the raw raw data, in the sense that, especially like in cases like Pariale, where you can image the same feature, the same nucleus, from many different views. If you have ambiguities, what it does or where it goes, you can follow it from many independent views. It's like having a crime scene. It's better to have many cameras, you know, of surveillance rather than having just one. Okay? It's exactly the same idea. All right, this is how it works. I thought that I would have some time to demonstrate it, but I will not do it, okay, in the sake of time. But obviously, those of you who want to track a few cells, in other words, if you don't want to have automated annotations, please come and find me. So this is the same link that was acquired from one view, say the ventral one, the lateral, and the ventrolateral. And of course, the nice thing about Big Data Viewer, which is at the core of Mammoth, is that you can rotate the specimen in any possible direction. So you can slice the data any how you want. And all these windows are linked. In other words, every time you click one cell here, it's using the transformation parameters that you have calculated to identify the same cell in all other available views. And it's also linked to another window that we call Track Scheme, which is the lineage browser. So all this, because it's interactive, if you make a mistake or if you want to edit your lineage, you can do that interactively from the Track Scheme. And last but not least, what is really important for biologists is to be able to do a visual inspection of their data. That's why we have also included an animation, which is a 3D animation of all the reconstructed or all the tracked cells. That again, they can be color-coded by lineage, they can be color-coded by numerical features like displacement, velocity, and so on. This is how it looks, the layout on your computers. You have the different viewer windows with the raw data. This is the 3D viewer for the animation of cells, and this is the Track Scheme window for the editing of the lineage tree. And what I will describe today is entirely done by manually, which means that me and Carsten spent about 2 or 3 months, 12 hours a day clicking cells, okay? Which is, you know, I don't recommend it to anyone, but it's, you know, when you analyze something for the first time, it's better to generate this ground truth data, and then of course you can compare this ground truth data against any new automated annotations. But again, because we had this unpleasant experience, we teamed up also with Philip Keller and Fernando Amat, which in the meantime, they had developed a great algorithm for tracking and for tracking cells. So in other words, what we can do now in Mammoth, we don't only import the view data, but we also import the automated annotations. In other words, we can use Mammoth both to generate our lineages from scratch manually, or we can use it to edit the automated annotations generated at this point by TGMM, which is the name of this algorithm. Hopefully, in the future, we can do the Elastic as well. And this is how it looks like. So you see now this this cloud of points, which very nicely represent all the different cells. OK? But as Andy Oates, you know, very nicely demonstrated in the first day, we don't necessarily need to rely on these in toto reconstructions to get some first biological insights. So what I will describe today are basically the insights we had by following painstakingly the few cells that make a single appendage. All right, so this summarizes the different features of Mammoth. Again, please come and talk to me if you are interested in using it. So the rest of the talk will focus on this cell. So this is the ectoderm. Again, for the vertebrate people, I need to highlight here that the problem of morphogenesis, of appendage morphogenesis in insects and Pareale, it's an ectodermal problem. It's not a mesodermal or mesenchymal one. Okay? So what we reconstructed here is the ectoderm in the early germ bank, and we followed these cells that give rise, as you will see, to the second thoracic limb here. So we tracked all the cells, and we're reconstructing the limb over 2 days at single-cell resolution. All right? So let's see what we can make with this kind of data. And this brings me back to Hans Meinhardt and the compartment and compartment boundary model. So the way that drosophilists have been able to identify compartments in Drosophila is by making clones. So either using genetic means or using X-rays, they have been able to label one cell and then follow its fate. So if this clone touches a compartment boundary, it has a straight outline. Otherwise, it has an irregular outline. And let me answer also the question why, in the case of the leg disc, Hans Meinhardt had a T instead of a cross. So most of this work was done originally by García Bellido in the wing, where you can very nicely identify the AP and the DV boundaries. Another guy called Emil Steiner did the same analysis in the leg, and again he was able very nicely to identify the anterior-posterior boundary. So as he noted, in the leg we found clearly defined anterior and posterior compartments very early in embryogenesis as well. The border runs along the leg, separating the two claws at its most distal point, down here. Posterior compartments are smaller than the anterior ones, analogous to the earliest compartments of the wing. At the second larval instar, development of a further restriction could be shown, subdividing the anterior compartment into a dorsal and a ventral region, again like in the wing. This border probably corresponds to the dorsal ventral demarcation line in the wing. It does not seem to be as clearly defined as the dorsal ventral border. This means that about 95% of the clones were respecting the DV boundary, but there was a 5% of clones that didn't. Or the anterior-posterior border in the leg, however. In the small posterior compartment of the legs, no clear division could be detected. Okay? This is the reason why Hans Meinhardt finally, I realized, had a T instead of a cross when he was trying to develop his models for the leg. At least I believe so. Unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to talk to him in person. All right. So it's now a good time to introduce you to the Pareale germband architecture. Obviously, some of you have already realized that it's very precise. And what you see as rows here corresponds to Drosophila parasegments. So the way that this embryo forms is you have scattered cells. At least this is how traditionally it's described. I don't believe this, but for the time being, we stick to this interpretation. You have scattered cells that become progressively aligned in very precise rows. So this is one parasegment row. And then these parasegmental rows undergo very stereotypic divisions parallel to the anterior-posterior axis. That's why one row of cells gives rise to two rows, and then two rows give rise to four rows. Okay? And this is how the germband elongates posteriorly, together with the addition of more rows at the posterior end. So the way we describe these rows is A, B, C, D, when they have not divided yet, A, B, and C, D, when they have divided for the first time, and then A, B, C, and D, when they have divided for the second time. Yes, please.
Has toppling, in a sense, will all these purple make one limb bud, or does growth...
I'll explain all this now. So at the same time, you see this very nice organization dorsoventrally. So this is the ventral midline, and this is the dorsal side. Again, the cells are aligned in very nice columns, and we use numbers to denote these columns. So zero is the midline, and then as you go away, it's 1, 2, 3, and so on. So what I told you already is that columns 0, 1, and 2 give rise to the new ectoderm and the sternites. That's why we're not going to talk about this at all today. All right. So what was the question here? The question is, we have a single specimen. Of course, we have now done it for other specimens as well. But we have a single specimen. By following the cell dynamics, can we identify the lineage restrictions? And the rules are very easy, very simple. So as you can imagine, compartments are polyclones, so they are made of many starting cells. So if we assign the four colors of the four compartments to individual cells and let the movie play, can we identify fields of cells that do not mix and make sharp compartments between themselves? Okay? All right. So let's do it first for the anterior-posterior compartment. So the anterior-posterior, as I told you already, becomes divided progressively into rows A, B, C, and D. And going to Mather's question, you see the parasegment and the anterior parasegment E4 in this case, and the neighboring one in 5. Like in Drosophila, the morphological limb is made out of two neighboring compartments. Okay? So the anterior compartment of the limb is made by these cells, and the posterior compartment is made by these cells. Okay? But this we knew already. Why? First of all, because this is highly conserved across the arthropods. And secondly, because we have highly, you know, we have reagents like the expression of the engrailed gene that very nicely demarcates the posterior compartment. So we knew already since 20 years now that this is the case, that the boundary between anterior and posterior cells is between D and A. Okay? And this is shown nicely here. Okay? You have a very nice line separating the cyan cells from the magenta cells. Okay? You follow me so far? So let's now do the same thing for the dorsoventral axis. As I told you, the cells are aligned in very precise columns of cells. So can we identify the dorsoventral compartment boundary in between two neighboring columns? To simplify things, the answer is no. So if you follow cells labeled by columns, you see that they mix between themselves. Okay? In other words, the dorsoventral compartment boundary was a bit more tricky to identify, but nevertheless, we found it. So the compartment boundary runs as a horseshoe. So this is like it's a magic word. So the dorsoventral boundary runs for some time. This is the early stage embryo. For some time parallel to the AP axis, then it crosses it, and then it runs again parallel to the AP axis. Okay? But if you evolve this model, in this case, keep in mind that we have the posterior cells with light colors and the anterior cells with dark colors, and the DV separation is green and magenta. Okay? So if you follow the cells between the green and magenta cells, you see that they make a very straight boundary between themselves. Okay? It's probably shown best here. Okay? And here.
You know, in a way, that's exactly what happens by the time the wing has achieved its final shape. Mm-hmm. The DV and the AP that were orthogonal, in the end, the DV really curves around mm-hmm. to be a horseshoe that's parallel mm-hmm. to...
Yes.
So this is just doing that all the time.
Yes, but so... unlike Drosophila, it's doing it from the early embryonic stage. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a big question, how this heterochronic shift that Drosophila has, you know, had to evolve. And we have no clue, obviously, how can be one system can transition to the other. But the other thing that persuaded us that we have the right subdivision of cells is the intersection of the four compartment boundaries. Remember what Meinhardt postulated, that the DV axis always falls at the intersection of the two systems, the AP and the DV. So the intersection between the four compartments always stays at the very tip of the appendage. Okay? So sometimes biology can be really rewarding and very, very simple, you know, to explain. It doesn't happen often. All right, now let me get into... So once we have solved the lineage restrictions, then we want to get some insights into the actual cell behaviors that may be driving the outgrowth of the limb. Again, I need to specify here that all this is done at the phenomenological level, all right? This is just pure descriptions, but I think we have, you know, some pretty good evidence that this might be, you know, causally related, all right? So what we knew before starting this analysis were two things, that it's oriented cell divisions that play a big role in shaping the Drosophila appendages. You heard about this from Suzanne yesterday. And also cell shape changes. So in this case, this would be the proximodistal axis, and you see that the cells are highly anisotropic, perpendicular to the proximodistal axis. Unfortunately, we don't have membrane markers for Pariale yet, but judging from the, if I use the nuclei as a readout of cell shapes, I can tell you that the same situation holds also true for Pariale, okay? But for the time being, I will basically try to convey you the information that we have from nuclear tracking. All right, so when it comes to oriented cell divisions, this is also the case for Pareale. What I told you in the beginning is that the first divisions of one row to two rows and then to four rows happen parallel to the AP axis. Okay? In other words, they have to be perpendicular to the AP boundary. This is exactly what we see. But as the limb buds start forming and elongating along the proximodistal axis, you have basically a progressive change in the orientation of divisions parallel to the growth axis, parallel to the proximodistal axis, very similar to what has been observed in Drosophila. Okay? And then, yeah? And then, the million-dollar question about... So this is something that I'm proud to say that has never been studied in Drosophila because people do not have the resolution to do it, okay? So in this case, we have single-cell resolution. We have we know the information for every single cell, where it is, when it divides, and what is the relationship to all other cells. This allowed us for the first time to calculate the cell proliferation rates in the forming and in elongating limb primordium. So for your help, I have denoted here the compartment boundaries. So the cyan one is the AP compartment boundary, and the green is the DV compartment boundary. Okay? So you will see these lines here, just so that you can orient relative to the compartment boundaries. Light colors mean fast dividing. Darker colors mean slowly dividing. Okay? So if we would believe the Drosophila paradigm, what we would expect is to have uniform proliferation rates. At least this is what people have identified in the wing. Okay? In the leg, we don't have this information yet. Correct? Correct me if I'm wrong. You know, all the Drosophilists are in the audience, please correct me. This is not what we find in the Pareale primordium. We find from the very beginning a distinct differentiation between the cells in the center of the primordium compared to the peripheral cells. This is very reminiscent, at least to me, not to any invertebrate models, but to the vertebrate limb. So what has been formulated by Louis Volpelt already 40, 50 years ago is the so-called growth morphogenetic model, whereby you have basically a gradient of proliferation rates from the proximal to the distal part of the developing appendage.
But I thought in the limb bud it was also very uniform, the proliferation.
In the Drosophila. You mean?
In the vertebrate limb bud.
At least in the cheek. So this is done by BRDU. Obviously, they don't have single cell resolution dynamics. But based on BRDU, etc., you can clearly see a gradient of proliferation rates along the proximodistal axis. But James Sharp, in the mouse. Let me tell you something. So James Sharp in Barcelona has revisited this question in the mouse. So in the mouse, again, they can make clones, of course, but they cannot have access to the single cell dynamics during limb bud formation. Okay? So what he showed is that by doing modeling is that, again, you can have a gradient of proliferation rates. But in order for this proliferation rate gradient to explain the growth rate of the actual limb, it's not as fast. So in order to explain the pace at which the limb bud develops in the mouse, okay, you have to have the difference in proliferation rates between the distal cells and the proximal cells of at least 8 times.
But people have done BRDU incorporation in mouse.
Yes, and it's only 2.5 times. So there is still a gradient. So you have basically the distal cells dividing 2 to 3 times faster than the proximal cells. But according to James's modeling, this is not enough to explain the rate at which the mouse limb bud grows. Okay? So this is one thing that Madhav, I would like to help your help. I can give you the exact numbers in terms of proliferation rates, and I would be very very much interested to see whether we can model the outgrowth of the Pareale limb bud. All right? So this is the first application of your expertise. Okay, let's now go to the later stages. By the way, another very speculative aspect of these observations is how the limb bud forms. So again, we have no clue how this is done. Okay, but if you follow the cell dynamics, you see that the dorsal and ventral surfaces, they come together soon after you have this elevation of cells, because what we believe because of the differential proliferation rates. Then the two surfaces, the dorsal and ventral, they come together. Unfortunately, we don't have the data yet, the gene expression. You know, we have obviously a lot of candidate genes from Drosophila to study whether this is indeed the case, whether we have asymmetric gene expression between dorsal and ventral cells. But this is obviously something that we will do in the immediate future. This is highly speculative, but let's now go back to the actual data. So this is now the next question is what drives the elongation of the limb bud? We already talked about the oriented cell divisions. Now, in terms of cell proliferation rates, we see again a regionalization in terms of proliferation. So these cells that lie at the intersection between the two compartment boundaries, they divide faster, which makes sense. This is essentially the growth zone of the developing limb bud. It needs to accumulate, you know, cell mass to accompany the growth of the limb. And this is exactly what we see. So we see more material being formed here at the tip of the limb. And the other thing that came really not really as a surprise, but of course, you know, we always have only Drosophila to compare to, is we see these cells that are abutting the anterior-posterior compartment boundary that are dividing faster. Okay? All right, so this is the profile of cell proliferations. Now let me comment a bit. Yes, go ahead.
Maybe you already told us, but what do you think is the sort of purpose of these very oriented cell divisions early? Like, yeah, it seems to be quite unique. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen such clear patterns before. What would happen in terms of?
I think there are two things that are also related. One is the lineage restriction. So if you go to this slide, you see that the compartment boundaries, especially the posterior ones, they are very, very thin. They are one or two cells wide. Okay, that's why if you make clones in the posterior compartment, they are always elongated. If you go to the dorsal compartment, where there are many more cell rows, then you can see that they have also more spherical, more around these columns, clones. And the other thing, of course, is mechanical. But again, we have not done any myosin staining, so I cannot really make more comment. Okay, and this is also you know, I don't want to show you the onion again, but this is again the quest for the ultimate and proximal causes. So what comes first, what comes second, okay? I cannot tell you that right now what is the cause for the other, okay? So in terms of gene expression, let me comment now about how you transform the two-dimensional model of Drosophila into the three-dimensional model of Pareale. So in Drosophila, all the patterning takes place in the two-dimensional epithelium, disc epithelium. So the green would be DPP, and the red would be wingless. So you have, in this case, high levels of DPP and wingless overlapping here in the center. Then you have lower levels in concentric rings as you go from the center to the periphery of the disc. So this is exactly how the leg disc is specified in distinct domains. Such a pattern would not be applicable to a three-dimensional organ. So just think about it, okay? Because you would activate the distalase, which is the gene that gets activated by the high levels of the two signaling pathways, along the proximodistal axis as well. So, yes? So essentially, what people predicted more than 10 years ago is that you would have this one of the two signaling pathways, or both, being expressed at the tip, okay, and one of them could continue being expressed as a stripe. Then you can nicely envisage that again you have a zone of high signaling, intermediate, and low. Okay. All right. In terms of gene expression, conservation of gene expression patterns, some of them are widely conserved and some are not. Among the highly conserved ones are, as I told you already, the segment polarity genes, engrailed and wingless. So wingless might be the gene, at least we presume, that is expressed here in these cells that are dividing faster. Okay, it's abutting, if this is the engrailed territory here, with the dark cells, with the slow dividing cells, then wingless stripe must be here. Okay, and of course we don't know yet whether it's expressed both in the dorsal and in the ventral compartment. This is something that we don't know yet. But then when it comes to DPP, we have already good evidence, not only from spiders shown here, but also from other species, that DPP is expressed only at the tip of the limb. Okay? Again, this is something that is ongoing in the lab. I will be able to tell you more in the next courses. Okay? Last but not least, since we had all this information, we try to reconstruct the lineage of the full appendage. This is the final morphology of the second thoracic limb. And as you can see nicely with this color coding made by Carsten, it's made of seven segments. So from distal to proximal, that are color-coded by, you know, darker colors. So what Karsten did over the last couple of months is he tracked all the cells all the way from early germline until the late differentiation. This is more or less what Ken and did, you know, more than 15 years ago for Drosophila, but he used, you know, new molecular markers like KNOTS to identify the subdivisions of the leg discs. Okay. In this case, we used morphological markers, which are the depressions, circumferential depressions during as the different segments are formed. And the question was very simple. So how early is the proximodistal information organized at the cellular level? And strikingly, this is done from very early on. From the very early on, you see a separation between proximal, distal and proximal values, okay? Which is again something not expected based on the gene expression. Based on the gene expression, what people have believed so far is that you have very early specification of the most distal and the most proximal values, distal S versus extradentical homothorax T-shirt, and then you have intercalary growth of the Daxan domain, okay? But at the cellular level, this is not what we see. We see very, very early distinction of the proximodistal phase. And very, very interestingly, we saw the very first separation is between, let me see now, between the basis and the ischium, which is also the broad subdivision between the proximal part of the limb, which is the coxopodite, and the distal part, which is the telopodite. Okay? And later on, of course, you have demarcation of the more and more segments.
Can you just go back and say how you mapped that to that?
Yes, so basically what, Karsten can also jump in any time. Essentially, he, as I told you already, some of the cells, especially in the posterior compartment, but also in the anterior one, they have very thin clones, okay? Because they are only one or two cell wide. If you just follow three or four cells that happen to be in a very thin compartment, by just following these four cells over time, you can reconstruct the full proximodistal axis. So this is exactly what we did. We did it for a row of cells in the anterior compartment and for a row of cells in the posterior compartment. This is, I think, the posterior, right? Okay. So essentially, this is the mediolateral organization of columns. Okay? And what you can see already here is that these yellow and white cells are the ones that will form the more distal segments in the limb. Okay? These kind of orangey cells, okay, are the ones that are give rise to the intermediate segments. And the more proximal ones, the dark colored ones, will give rise.
Okay, so one color there corresponds to
yes.
multiple colors
mm-hmm.
in there. Okay,
all right.
Tassos, I'm not sure I'm understanding how the observation that you get more growth on the tip mm-hmm. fits with the size of these different regions.
So basically the way that I interpret this is that, as I told you already, this distal part of the limb, okay, is the one that needs to grow out. We didn't talk at all about the relative size of the different segments. But essentially, most of the limb, or, you know, I don't want to go back now, but basically, if you see the cuticle prep, you see that most of the limb is basically coming from this part. So it makes really sense for me that this distal part of the limb bud is what has the highest proliferation rate.
And cells in the very first one that aren't colored or not part of the limb, the
yes,
body wall.
Yes. So this is what I was telling you, that these guys give primarily rise to the neurectoderm and the sternites, and these ones give rise to the tergites. Okay.
So the positional information along outgrowth is defined by what?
No, I didn't explain it at all. I tried to stay away from it for the sake of time, but if you're asking. Okay, so the patterning of the proximodistal axis is an interplay of all major signaling pathways and a lot of transcription factors, okay? So we focus here now. As you see, we discussed already the DPP and Wingless that are activated basically at the anterior cells that are abutting the posterior compartment, okay? So these cells that experience very high levels of both DPP and Wingless are those ones that will express distales. Distales is the transcription factor that first of all is required to specify the primordia, and later on it's required to specify the distal parts of the limb, okay? Later on you have, so at a concentric ring like that here, you have the intermediate phase that are experienced in these duct genes, okay? And the more distant cells that are here close to the body wall, okay, are the ones that express a lot of markers, like homothorax, extradenticle, T-shirt, and so on. Okay? And then on top of that, once you start growing the proximodistal axis, you have another system, the AGF R system, so epidermal growth factor, that is expressed at the tip of the limb and subdivides the tarsal segments, I think. And finally, you have also notches being activated at the joints to demarcate these joints of the limb. Okay.
Are we told that there is still sort of one morphogen gradient system which graded level is defining all of these fates of
the
cells, or is this some sort of a dynamic program that is played out at the tip?
I think in the beginning you have these two. So it seems that you have two systems in the very beginning, okay? So you create an intermediate pattern, and then you have one system that gets superimposed on this one by EGF receptor, and then another one by notch. So basically, it's like, you know, more systems are building on pre-existing information, okay?
Parietal appendages, where you have these, I'm not quite sure how much information you have, but you have these proximal distal fates.
Mm-hmm.
And so would they map relative to distance from the DPP source, which is your distal tip, or are they using information from both compartment boundaries?
So we haven't done this analysis yet, so but we have the distances, obviously. But we have to confirm first that DPP is expressed at the tip. So once we have this information confirmed, because I mean we are doing the gene expression studies now, I will do this analysis. This is the first in the row. Once we confirm that DPP, because right now we have data from spiders and from some other insects. So like in grillus, for example, I think is Taro here. Do you have DPP being expressed as a spot or as a stripe?
Spot.
As a spot. So I mean it's 99% sure that DPP will be expressed as a spot, also in Pariale, if we, you know, this is the most parsimonious explanation I can give. But before we confirm it, I haven't done this analysis. Okay? Okay, so what I showed you now was completely focusing on a single limb. Okay? But as you can imagine, in the next many years, the most informative analysis will be by comparing different types of appendages. And you can envisage different types of comparisons. One is between the same type of appendage, between the left and the right side. Again, Suzanne mentioned this yesterday, that we have no clue how the left and right sides talk to each other and they know, you know, to make the same proportion and the same size of stuff. And in this case, because we can image both sides at single cell resolution, I think we will start getting some information about this. The second level is what I explained already, across embryos. So I just showed you data from a single embryo, but obviously we have extended this to other embryos. And although we don't have now the tools yet to be able to compare lineage trees, this is currently under development in Janelia, the ability to be able to compare branching patterns. Okay, so I will be able to tell you how stereotypic or variable are the cell behaviors within a single appendage across embryos or between left and right side. The other level of analysis of comparison is between serially homologous appendages. This is what inspired development of Pariale as a model system in the first place, the diversity of limbs. So obviously we will be doing this analysis, this comparison, not only at the genetic level, but also at the cellular level. And last but not least, we developed, obviously, as I told you already, the CRISPR technology. And the very first gene that we did is Distales, for obvious reasons. First of all, it's directly related to our stuff. And secondly, it has a very specific role in appendage morphogenesis. So you are missing the distal parts of the limbs. So, and of course, we can do both the knockout, and this is the limbless animal, and we can do the knock-in, so we have a very nice reporter with single-cell resolution again. And this is the movie that I took from before coming here. So this is an embryo that was, this is a G0. So this is an embryo that was injected with Cas9 and short guide RNA targeting distales. And I want you to tell me which side is the mutant and which is the wild type. Okay? I will explain later why you have these problems with the focusing of the light sheet. But please, right now, can you identify which is the mutant side? So who votes for this side that's being the mutant? And who votes for this one as being the mutant? All right, so the first guys win, okay? So do you see this gap in the pattern here? It's not, no? I will play it again. Anyway, so this is just a crappy maximum projection that I had time to do. Obviously, you know, this rendering, as we discussed, takes, you know, it can take basically more than a month to process this movie to have these nice renderings with single cell resolution. Essentially, as we expected from the lineage, by blocking distales, it's not that we completely abolished limbed outgrowth, but basically we completely abolished the second phase. Okay? So we have the limbed forming, you see here. But it will never extend now, okay? It's forming, but it stays dormant. And we have no clue why this is the case. Are the cells dying? Are the cells dividing in not proximodistally, but in other orientations? This is something obviously that will follow soon, okay? Can you see that you have a small limbed here that never grows? Okay. So with this, last but not least, my PhD supervisor, he's now in Lyon, and he's doing the regenerative morphogenesis. What I have been describing so far is developmental morphogenesis. The beautiful thing about Pariale, and this is what you asked in the beginning, is that you can do regeneration experiments. So if you cut the limb after embryogenesis, in between molds, it will regenerate a new limb. So Michalis has been able to glue this hatch, this larvae on a cover slip and image them over several days. And this is what you will see here. So this is a limb that has been amputated here. You have single cell resolution and you will see how the new limb is forming now. Okay? So you see massive proliferation at this point. And then all these cells start getting patterned into distinct segments that grow. Okay. Obviously, there is not enough space. That's why it's convoluted. Okay. But nevertheless, the main take-home message is for the first time we have an animal model where we can compare, you know, at single cell resolution, both, you know, limb morphogenesis, both during normal development as well as during regeneration. Again, I cannot really tell you any more details because this is unpublished work, but there are some striking similarities. Okay. All right. So there are many, many people who have been involved in this analysis. I would like to primarily thank my lab, Valia, Sugias, and Andy, who have developed all the nice tools to perturb gene function. Philip and David Stern have been my mentors in Janelia, so they helped me set up my lab. And of course, Pavel, who introduced me into light microscopy in the first place. It has been a fantastic collaboration with Tobias, who is a postdoc in Dresden, and Jean-Yves, who used to be in Dresden, but now is in the Pasteur Institute in Paris. Of course, Carsten is a lifelong friend and collaborator. The two Stefans, again, they started from Pavel's lab, but now they have their own groups in Berlin and in Janelia, and they're also experts on image processing, and many, many more people and lifelong collaborators. So thank you very much for your attention. Yes.
So I guess it's much harder to detect rearrangements with a nuclear label, but potentially you could see them if you just labeled two adjacent cells in their progeny and just held. Mm-hmm. Do they separate along the process?
Okay, we did that. Obviously, we couldn't restrain. So in the beginning, you don't have any rearrangements, contrary to our expectations. But later on, during the elongation phase, you see that you have basically intercalations, again, that are, let's say, parallel to the proximodistal axis. And we believe that this contributes to the narrowing of the cylinder, of the limb, and elongation as well. So we have only two instances during this first, let's say, phase that we image the single cell resolution. But I envisage that later on, in order to achieve all the different shapes of segments, you will have much, much more pronounced.
Can you find a time? So you notice that the nuclei, as you pointed out, get a bit compressed along the proximal distal axis.
Yes.
And then is there a time in development, say, where that shape relaxes and it is correlated with another little extra extension? Or
I haven't studied this in detail yet. What was really striking for me was this packing of the nuclei that I told you violates the Hertwig rule that we had from Johann Beles. Okay? So basically the cells... if I can draw it here, it's like sucking sandbags. Okay, so if this is proximodistal axis, so this is proximal and this is distal. Okay, the cells are arranged like that. Nevertheless, they don't obey Hertwig's rule. I mean, this is an extrapolation from the nuclear shape. Okay, they don't divide like that, as one would expect, but they divide preferentially like that. Okay? This is all I can tell you right now.
So if you just try to, so let's say...
But this, when it relaxes, this is obviously something we can easily see. I mean, we have the data set here, we can check it.
Just have the cell divisions really trying hard to go proximal distal, but somehow the whole tissue just can't expand that fast.
Yes.
So,
mm-hmm.
So it ends up compressing the cells, but then over longer time scales, mm-hmm. once you stop the divisions, you get that extra little
that
bit
would,
of...
That would make sense in light of your data, definitely. Yeah, this is something we can check in my office now.
Okay.
All right?
Yes.
Is it possible to image
myosin
in this
earlier? Oh, yes. I mean, right now we don't have the transgenics to do the myosin, but we have RNA. So at the very least, what I would like to do with the students is to see whether we have, you know, a myosin preferential accumulation in the grid.
Yeah.
So this is something we will do.
So you'll be able to do it?
Yes, we'll try at least.
Okay. I'm guessing that you think that this budding is differential growth as opposed to something similar to what Stas and on dorsal appendage, which is these myosin cables that kind of peel this epithelial sheet into 3D. I think you think it's differential growth that's driving this bud formation. Is that
it's
to get you a basic sense of?
I think it's a combination of differential growth,
yes.
And oriented divisions.
Okay.
I found also very interesting, maybe a part of the development that maybe you can describe a lot, which is the initial one, because you have all these cells that are organized in row, but also in columns. So
mm-hmm.
if there are so many, probably four-way vertices everywhere. I mean, we never looked at the junction, but I'm sure. So it means that instead of having cells which are packed in hexagons, at the beginning they must be really packed in squared cells. So does this play any role then in the development of the limbs? Do you know if there's any mechanism that makes the cells so square?
So this is a stage that we have not touched yet, okay? But I think I have seen only a single membrane staining with phalloidin or whatever, and you see exactly as you expect, you know, square cells. Okay, it's one question, what makes the original grid, you know, such, you know, the precision of the original grid, and it's another question why it keeps being, you know, why you have perfectly aligned columns. One very important contribution to that is the alignment of the mitotic divisions parallel to the proximodistal axis. If you remember, I told you that you have one row that becomes two and then four. So these divisions are perfectly aligned, you know, longitudinally. Of course, the two can be, you know, they can crosstalk, but we have no clue what. Yeah.
I mean, that means that the T1 transition are impaired. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you have these
yes,
divisions,
definitely
but then
they are impaired.
Normally they
yeah.
want to also
mm-hmm.
readjust.
Yes. But already from the very beginning, when the cells are organized in the grid, they are already arranged,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
that's,
almost
that's
in perfect
already,
order.
I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep. So maybe I can add something. There might be an evolutionary origin because the antipodes, they
yes.
belong to the malacostrican crustaceans, and all of the malacostricans beside antipodes, they have these ectotiloblasts that give in a wave-like manner all the material that later on forms the trunk. But only the antipodes, they change their way of doing it by just arranging themselves like this.